Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new edition of our program, Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg. I'm clinical professor of psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. It's a pleasure to welcome you to another one of our programs where we chat with esteemed colleagues in clinical psychopharmacology, discussing issues of importance to practitioners in diagnostics, assessment, patient management, things that go outside the realm of CME, that go outside the realm of formal didactics. And hopefully in the next 40, 45 minutes or so, we'll have a chance to let you be the fly on the wall, hearing some, I hope, really great conversations on a topic that I am certain everyone listening to this program today contends with, which is the topic of adherence to treatment in psychopharmacology. And so with us today is a dear friend and colleague, one of my favorite people, Dr. Martha Sajatovic. Martha is not just one of my favorite people because her CV is extensive, and I'll read items up from it in a moment. But she's someone who I think embodies the psychiatrist practitioner who really demonstrably cares about patients. For example, she was the recipient of the Exemplary Psychiatrist Award bestowed by NAMI. She was a recipient of the Gerald Clareman Investigator Award from the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. She's been recognized for her work that's patient-oriented, and it always helps us to remind ourselves why we're in this field to begin with, is to try to make patients' lives better, to be able to have some role in improving the welfare and well-being of the people with mental illnesses that we work with. So Martha really embodies that, and I'm sure you'll see that come across in our discussion today. Dr. Sajatovic is the Willard Brown Chair in Neurological Outcomes at the University Hospitals Cleveland Medical Center and the Rocco L. Motto Professorship in Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. She's professor of psychiatry at the School of Medicine at, it is Case Western Reserve University still, in conjunction with Cleveland Medical Center. She's the director of the Geropsychiatry Program, has done extensive work in clinical psychopharmacology, particularly in older adults, but across all ranges, and is one of the most informed people I can think of when I have a question about an adherence issue, about management of what gets in the way of good care, obstacles for patient outcomes. So with that, Martha, welcome to our show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Joe. Always a pleasure to do so many different programs and activities. So thank you for involving me.
For sure. Well, this one, again, is really for our viewers and our listeners who I am sure, as I say, are struggling with issues about adherence. So if we're going to just to start out by saying, why is adherence a thing in psychiatry? How does it occur? What should the clinician be thinking about just at front of mind when the topic of adherence is in their heads?
Yeah, so adherence really, you know, if we back up a little bit and think about sort of the definition of what adherence is, it is an individual's alignment, behavioral alignment, and there's attitudinal alignment, but also, you know, if we think about it in the most practical sense, alignment with a treatment plan, whether it's a prescribed medication or some other instructions, you know, how much does that person engage with that behavior. So what I think is kind of the problem, well, I mean, there's two problems in clinical care, is one is that an imperfect alignment is a lot more common than most clinicians think it is. So, you know, especially for those of us who prescribe medications or come up with a very specific treatment plan, we will often make the assumption that, you know, however we write a prescription or what we put in a progress note is what actually happens. However, the evidence doesn't support that. So if we look at the evidence base of medication prescription with psychotropic drugs, generally, the data suggests that about half the people who are prescribed a given psychotropic medication have trouble with following or being aligned with the recommendations. So I would say that the first problem is that mismatch between what we think is happening and what actually happens. And then the second problem is it's not just a question of, oh, the person is doing what the doctor said or not doing what the doctor said or doesn't agree with, but the consequences of suboptimal or poor adherence, which can be extensive. So there's a very robust literature that suggests, excuse me, that suggests that poor adherence is associated with relapse and poor clinical outcomes. It's associated with costs. So relapse often leads to hospitalization, inefficient use of resources. So people end up getting, you know, not showing up for appointments. We know how disruptive that is in clinical settings. And then if there are symptomatic or functional consequences to poor adherence, clinicians will then sometimes compound that problem by making an assumption about, you know, their assumption is, oh, my treatment plan isn't working, or my prescription or my drug regimen isn't working, without necessarily appreciating that poor adherence or suboptimal adherence is the underlying cause. So the assumption is, oh, the person is refractory to this
medication.
I need to change the treatment, or I need to increase the dose or whatever. So it's kind of based on the false premise. So I think those two problems of not appreciating how pervasive adherence is and then the consequences of poor adherence are the things that I think as clinicians and researchers, we really need to think about.
And one of the tricky things, that's an excellent summary. And one of the things I would imagine doesn't happen, patients don't come in and say, so friendly start by saying, I'm not taking the medicine that you prescribe the way you're prescribing it, but let me tell you, you know, I'm taking 80% of it some days, or 70%, or the gradations, or reasons why I'm stopping it. There's a whole dialogue, I would think, that this realm opens up as to adherence. I'm assuming doesn't mean 100% perfect adherence. I don't always take the last day of my antibiotics. So how do we open the dialogue with the patient to make it non-judgmental and almost normally people have a hard time taking medicines, especially if you're on a lot of them. Do you have some thoughts about how to initiate the dialogue?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned this, and I think you hit the nail on the head, Joe, is how do we normalize this? So I was involved in a study a number of years ago where we looked at medication adherence with antipsychotic medications for people with serious mental illness in the VA system, right? And so the VA does have the ability, and has for many years, the ability to look at medication possession ratio. So basically kind of refills of prescribed antipsychotic drugs. And on average, what we saw is that the MPRs were around 75%, right? So people were taking about 75% of prescribed and that's just the refills. That doesn't count the medicine is at home in my medicine cabinet and I don't take it. So it's probably actually a little lower. So I think being able and willing to share that with people to say, look, the evidence suggests that it's hard for people to stay on track with medications. And it's really common. Is that an issue that you're struggling with, or does it happen to you sometimes? So kind of lay that groundwork that this is the evidence, like this is what we know. And then you allow that person the space to say, yeah, that happens to me, with kind of almost that permission.
We use the terminology adherence, and you mentioned alignment, as opposed to, I guess, what's more the antiquated term of compliance, because that has an implication that's off-putting. Is that right?
Correct. So I don't, you know, in the literature, being an adherence researcher and a clinician who's interested in the topic of adherence, I don't see the word compliance very much in like new publications. So I would say good riddance to the term, because it does imply that someone is directing or telling somebody, you know, these are the instructions and this is what you have to do. And then it does become kind of an adversarial or a punitive position. It's like, how do you stack up? You know, here's a test, and did you get 90% or 80%, or did you flunk the test? Whereas the alignment, and this is where this gets into the issue of shared decision making and candid dialogue, that, you know, we are each bringing something to the table, right? The clinicians can talk about why I'm prescribing a given medicine and the evidence base for what works, the patient who's taking that medications is bringing their experience, right? It works for me, or it doesn't work for me, or these have these horrible side effects that I absolutely just can't tolerate, and that's where that experience can come together.
So this is really inviting a dialogue, a collaboration, a discussion, rather than I've had dentists who say, flossing your teeth every day, right? How do you answer that?
Right. Or you don't, you're compliant with your medication, aren't you?
So, I mean, I'm just thinking about the ways this could really open doors because, in a way, you're sort of trying to ask the patient to collude with you, or let you and me against the world. I'm not here to judge, but at the same time, as you so wisely point out, if I wrongly assume that you're doing everything as prescribed and things aren't better, that might prompt me to change the treatment or change a dose or do something that's actually very inappropriate. If the real issue is you've taken it for 2 days, or you're taking less than prescribed, or there's a drug interaction. So it would seem to me this involving the patient, like, look at this with me together as a partner, because you and I both are trying to make your symptoms better, whether it's depression or anxiety or psychosis or cognition or whatever it is. But if we're not succeeding, then we together have to think through why are we not getting where we want to be? And one possibility is, are the medicines not doing their job because the doses right, or there's something about how it's being put into your body.
So
Do you open the door? Do you open the door for, yeah.
Well, I find it very useful to talk with folks about kind of the benefits versus the burden, right? We made a change last time I saw you. Was that better, worse, or the same? Or do you have some new issues that you're concerned about? So that it's in a way you can sort of remove the focus a little bit from adherence, even though that's something that you're going to get to. But tell me about what you see as good things versus not good things about this treatment.
Now, I could think of a bunch of things that could initiate a dialogue in a certain direction, in no special order. I don't know how these will get prioritized, but let's start with insight or diminished awareness of the need for medicine. How do you approach that delicate topic?
Yeah, so that's definitely an issue sometimes with some conditions more than others. So, Joe, you and I have both spent a lot of time doing research in people who have bipolar disorder. And I think that's a classic example of a condition where, depending on symptom severity and whatever polarity they're in, their insight can definitely fluctuate. And it's important for clinicians to consider that and have that discussion with their patients as well. Right. So I think the important thing to consider, especially in situations of fluctuating insight, is that adherence can also fluctuate. It's not a one-shot deal. Right. So people may have different patterns, but we can also think about what types of additional supports can we bring in with different levels of insight. So a person may not have the insight, or it brings up issues like cognitive impairment or distractibility. So people might miss medications for other type of syndrome related issues other than just insight. But could this is where family or other social supports can be helpful. And then thinking about the long game, right? So maybe somebody isn't seeing a clear connection between taking medicines and their current level of symptoms, but they may be able to look at the longer view, like, I want to go back to work, or I want to go back to school, or I want to have custody of my kids back. And what are the different things that I might need to do to get there? So that's where that dialogue and weaving adherence into it, I think, can be very helpful.
How about misattributions? I think the medicines you're giving me are making me worse. I think they're causing my symptoms as opposed to failing to alleviate them. I'm sure these people have come to your attention.
Yeah, for sure. I guess what I would try to do is to dig into that and ask them, what is worse? And what is better? I mean, sometimes they're right.
Well,
We did a number of studies, a study a number of years ago where we were substituting a medication to people who had bipolar disorders, and they had, you know, they were on polypharmacy, and asking people, you know, what do you think is the medication that's causing you the problem right now? You know, and so in conditions of polypharmacy, you know, it's very possible that that person is correct. Like, this is a side effect that I know. And so when we make modifications or we think about adherence issues, look at what you see as the biggest burden for you with this medication.
The pro-con concept you spoke about or alluded to before really, I think, depends on the patient's belief that a medicine can be helpful. And this gets into drug attitudes. If I've had depression incessantly, and I've tried a bunch of things, I may be very skeptical that anything's going to help. And so why bother? Demoralization, just skepticism about treatment. I wonder if that's, you know, a very honest experience far too many people can have in the world of treatment resistance, where you don't make assumptions, but you would probably want to know about their attitudes and expectations of what they think medicines can do for them.
Yeah, so you know, the whole issue of attitudes is one that I've gotten increasingly interested in recent years, and we actually have a couple of NIH funded research studies that are, you know, recently we've concluded enrollment. We're starting to look at data, and there's some really interesting correlates of, you know, different levels of adherence and different attitudinal domains. One thing that does seem like it's really popping out is self efficacy. Right. So the people who feel like I have agency and I'm empowered to make my health better and my life better, and that might involve, probably does involve, medication adherence as well as other lifestyle issues that we know are important. So, you know, does the person feel like they're kind of helpless and nothing they do makes a difference, as you alluded to in that scenario, versus I can do something about it, and you know, I can talk with my clinician, or I can get some additional supports, or maybe this medicine isn't a good one for me, and I need to get change, you know, make a change, or maybe I know because I have fluctuations in my symptoms and my severity and my lifestyle. Maybe I want to do something like go on a long-acting injectable medication where that might cover me if I have changes in how I'm feeling over time. But again, being able to feel like what I do makes a difference does appear to be a really critical component of medication adherence.
Certainly resonates with how any of us, you know, think about anything that we engage with. If I feel like this is going to help me, my dentist did get some progress with me on the flossing when he said, so do you know what pockets are in your gums? And do you know what it means to have a 6 millimeter pocket? So he explained it not in a scary way, but he said, basically, you know, if you're not sort of the consequence, you know, how do you phrase it? We all are vulnerable to having gum recession. And one way to avoid that is to floss. And I can show you how to do it, you know, effectively. And if you do that, there's a really low chance that you'll have your gums gonna. But if you don't do that, you know, Joe, that heard this phrase, long in the tooth. When you get older, that means that your gums are receding and you lose your teeth. And Joe, you don't want to lose your teeth, do you? He was a pretty good motivational interviewer. And didn't really feel judgy either, as opposed to saying, you know, the compliance side of things. So you are, in a way, I guess you are asking the patient, what do they prioritize? What are their goals? I want to keep my gums and my teeth. You probably don't want to be suicidal. You don't want to be in the hospital. You don't want to be able to work. Does motivational interviewing sort of play a role in
right. It absolutely does. And that's where I think, you know, the agency, the self-efficacy, right? So it is, you know, you're not a passive observer and you're just swallowing a pill that somebody gives you, but this is part of your health promotion and your plans for yourself. The other thing I think that's really critical when we talk about medication adherence is that's just one part of it, right? It's the part of getting well or recovery that we know that's important for a variety of mental health conditions, but it's also an opportunity to get beyond being the medication police, right, or the adherence police, right?
And if I can help us together figure out what the obstacles are, I mean, for instance, you mentioned polypharmacy before.
Yes.
The bipolar world, we've learned a lot of patients take many medicines. Do you find that that tends to be a high contributor to not so great adherence? You're on so many things that it just becomes chaotic.
Yeah, there is a literature not necessarily specific to bipolar disorder, but it has been seen in bipolar samples, is that the higher the medication burden, the more challenging it can be to stay on track with medication. So if you look at medication possession ratio or rates, high drug burden is a risk factor for lower medication adherence. That said, we know that for some conditions, the norm, like bipolar disorder, might be 2 to 3 medications. I mean, many people are on more, but it may be that you may not just be on one medicine. So what can we do to help you stay on track with that so that simply taking more pills is not in itself a barrier? So things like pill boxes, tying medication taking into a routine activity. What I would say, based on the evidence that we have, is a lot of suboptimal adherence is unintentional. So people don't set out and say, oh, you know, just like you probably say, I'm not going to floss today, right? Like that probably doesn't happen very much. But what's more likely to happen is, you know, it's bedtime and you realize you haven't flossed.
Yeah.
Right?
I forgot. Life is so busy.
So, so one of the techniques is to say, what do you do that is absolutely reliable that you do every day? You know, do you get up and you have your morning coffee? Do you do, you know, whatever? Can we tie medication into that routine activity so that you don't have to take the extra effort to think about medication taking?
What about stigma? What would you say about the role of stigma with medication? Every pill's a reminder.
Yes, very true. That's where that issue of polypharmacy and multiple dosing gets in, right?
I must be so badly off that I need massive.
Right. So stigma, unfortunately, is alive and well. People internalize stigma, right? Mm-hmm. So I must be a bad person that I'm on this medication. This is where I think the dialogue can help, right? These are evidence-based treatments. If you had high blood pressure, you wouldn't feel that you're a bad person because you have to take 3 medications for your hypertension, right? How is it? So trying to normalize that as well can be helpful. But as clinicians, we do know that things like reducing the number of times that people have to take medications, other forms of formulations that might make medication taking less of a focus. Social stigma. So if somebody is, say, living in a dorm room or at work and school, how can the person manage their life so they don't have to take medications where other people might ask them about that medication and they may feel like they have to share or divulge things that they prefer not to do. So, you know, just having that discussion about, you know, tell me what that feels like and are there ways that we can reduce this burden for you?
And that probably even comes before the whole adherence story. This has to do with how do you see yourself relative to having a mental health condition. And if I'm not mistaken, something like 1 in 5 people in the United States takes psychiatric medicine. So it's not exactly like this is a teeny, teeny minority of the population. Depression, 17% of the population. I mean, and anxiety disorders, 1 in 4. So, you know, back to normalization and also the autonomy that, you know, you could say, okay, I am the 1 in 4 people on this planet who contends with some mental health condition. What can I do to take manageability over that? Medicines as tools rather than as obligations.
Correct. I think that's where the self-efficacy and the agency kind of comes in. It's like, okay, I have hypertension or I have bipolar disorder. You know, what are the treatments that I need to take so that I can get on with my life and think about my other goals and my other priorities?
The family comes up from time to time in various ways. I wonder if I could ask you to free associate, as it were, to the good and the bad ways in which caregivers can and do play a role both for good and not necessarily
Yeah.
good when it comes to, are you taking your medicines? Or
Yeah,
those medicines?
yeah. Yeah, so there's this clinical lore, and much of it is accurate, that people who have psychosocial support or social supports tend to be more resilient and able to manage their problems better. You know, I get by with a little help from my friends. Absolutely true. Yet at the same time, especially if somebody has had more significant and more severe symptom relapses, families can be scared. They may overreact. They may feel like, I'm going to take control of this. You know, when somebody says to me, you know, when they come from an appointment, I see a lot of older patients, so I encourage them to bring their families with them. We
Sure,
kind of
sure.
meet together. And for me, it's always a little bit of a, like, I have to think about this when I ask somebody about their medicines and they turn to their spouse or and they say, you know, Margaret, do I need a refill? So,
Yeah.
you know, it can be helpful to have the family, but it puts pressure on them. It's also erroneous to assume that the family member is necessarily a supporter of medication adherence. So we have some adherence data that suggested in one of our bipolar samples is that up to 40% of family members did not feel that medication was indicated, or they felt the benefit did not exceed the burden for a variety of reasons. So it's helpful to know that. You know, is the family aligned with you as
Yeah,
well?
that's fascinating, especially if you put it together with some of the work that people like our colleagues David Michlewitz and Mike Goldstein have done on expressed emotions in families, you know, in bipolar disorder, where attitudes about the illness itself
Right.
and means of communication and expression are played out. So if there's an emotional over-involvement, a helicoptering, do you take your pills? Do you take your pills? Or a shaming that could go on, like, why are you still on that medicine? You didn't really need that. I mean, that impacts everything from self-appraisal and self-worth and self-esteem to the whole spirit of being in a partnership, that we're all in this together. You know, the taking of a it takes a village, that you'd hope everyone's aligned, but I guess part of the prescriber's role is to suss out to what extent are we all aligned, or if we're not, that's going to be a problem.
Right. And I think it is important to just be frank with our patients to ask them, you know, are there people in your life that tell you not to take medications? I mean, I think it's reasonable to ask that question up front, and the answers can be very illuminating. You may find out that, you know, people have often many individuals in their families or their social networks, and not everybody thinks the same, and they may share some information with this family member, but not with, you know, Uncle Joe, because Uncle Joe thinks that psychiatric medications are a crutch. So, you know, that's just not something we talk about with him, you know.
And how can we help you, the patient, crystallize your own perception of your health? And it's probably not just psychiatric. I mean, does Uncle Joe take his cardiac meds? He doesn't believe in cardiac meds. He believes in vitamins and exercise only. That's going to heal his coronary arteries. So, you know, how you think about health in a way seemingly precedes the whole discussion of adherence, or the context in which adherence plays out. Go
Absolutely.
back for a sec to what you were saying before about perceived efficacy. It's always seemed to me that if I or a patient of mine is taking something and it's not clear that they're benefiting, I can't blame them for being lukewarm about being in it. How do you think about sort of taking that aspect on in terms of how good a job do you think this treatment is doing for you? Because if it's not, why would you take something that's not doing a very good job in the first place?
Exactly. And I think it's also important to be candid with patients about kind of your general philosophy of treatment. So, I have two rules of thumb that when I see patients in clinical settings is I tell them that people should be on the lowest amount of medicine that they need, right? But that they need is sometimes a difficult thing. And when possible, I try to do just one thing at a time, so
Yeah,
that neither of
sure.
those things
Makes
are rocket science. But, explaining that to patients, say, but I need you to help me for both of those things, right? So we figure out what's the right medication dose for you. And if you feel like something truly, truly isn't helping you, then you need to tell me if you're missing some doses, right? So then we decide, are you still having trouble because you may not be at a therapeutic target or something to do with the pharmacokinetics or what we know about receptor profiles of drugs versus is there something else? Does it have a side effect that's non-negotiable for you, for instance? Right. So if you're taking a medication and maybe you don't have manic symptoms or you're not paranoid, but you've gained 60 pounds and now have diabetes, then that's a hard trade-off.
From day one, how do you forecast the possibility that I have things that I can offer that could help? Everything that I could think of has possible side effects. Even placebos have side effects. So, how do you instill to a patient the sense that I will be watching for this vigilantly and the balance between benefits and risks? And I want to hear about it. If the side effect is coming up, let's not bury our head in the sand.
So I think having the discussion up front, I truthfully do not go into exhaustive lists of side effects up front because I think that causes its own trouble. And most people when they go to the drugstore and they come back with those patient information sheets, if they actually read them, very often I'll get a call saying, "Oh my God,
For sure. Oh yeah. Or
like all
I
these."
can I read it online.
Yes. But my question to them is, do you feel like this is better, worse, or the same? And then depending on like just simple, do you feel like qualitative that this is just better for you? And if it's not, then let's try and figure out together why it's not, because that will inform our next steps.
We have options. I mean, hopefully, we always have options. I guess that's another aspect of agency for the patient. See someone on consultation who's on some medicine and they're still symptomatic, and you say, "How do you know how it's come to be you're still on this medicine?" I don't know. Well, has your prescriber talked with you about other options besides this particular medicine? Well, I see them once in a blue moon, and we don't really talk about that. You're almost sort of evaluating whether or not there's vigilance over the degree to which you're benefiting. Because if you're not benefiting, there may be other things that would be more useful than this. And before you vote with your feet by stopping an ineffective medicine, maybe the issue is more, could we do better?
And continually monitoring that. So, having done work for a number of years in the aging field, where people are put on medications when they're in their 20s or 30s and they age as they take those medications, kind of continually revisiting that. Is this working for you, right? Are you starting to get side effects?
And
So
for the person.
adherence, yeah, adherence is just part and parcel of managing side effects and benefit versus burden of medications.
And from the for the person you mentioned in older adults, or people with medical illnesses, those who come and say, "I'm on so many medicines," you've heard this phrase.
Yes.
How do you empathically acknowledge, yeah, you are on. But then you could be intellectually, well, this one's for this, this one's for this, this one's for
Yeah.
this, which is a little cerebral, but how do you approach that sort of, plight, a
Yeah.
polyplot?
Yeah, and I think being willing to listen and revisit what they're on, right? So maybe I'm on four medications for bipolar disorder. Maybe I don't need to be on four medications, right? I had a patient recently who was on four medications, and she didn't think that her Lamotrigine, and she'd been on them forever, forever, ever. She didn't think that her Lamictal, her lamotrigine, was helping her. And so, we did a taper, and a year later, she's off of it and feels that that was helpful. Right. I don't know that I would say her life is better without. I don't think it was something that was causing burden. But again, the idea of I feel that it's you should be on the smallest amount of medicine that you need.
As you say, that you need, that it's effective. If it's not effective, we need to ask, is that because of the dose? Is that because it's the wrong medicine? Is it in an inappropriate medicine? Which brings me to, so Martha, you and I have been involved in a task force with the ASCP on deprescribing, and you and I have a paper coming out soon in JAMA Network Open that was a survey of an expert panel on issues of deprescribing. And one of the endorsed items that came through this Delphi survey with over 90% agreement was the basic concept that on a regular periodic basis, clinicians should have a formal review with their patients of their regimen. And this may seem intuitively obvious, but almost like a review of personnel at a company. So let's do your annual review. What are you on? What's it doing for you?
Right.
Is it doing more for you than to you? And are there alternatives? Really, is meant to instill agency, but the expert panel that you and I were part of really strongly felt that if you're not sitting down and doing that kind of review, things can fall through the cracks.
Absolutely, and that sort of directly ties into the adherence issue. So if my patient and I work together and we regularly look at my treatments to see, you know, is the benefit exceeding the burden? I am going to have a level of credibility and trust with that person that I'm really paying attention. I'm listening to you. And so we can have a candid discussion. If you tell me that something really isn't working for you, then we can work together to find the option, right? But if I just tell you, you need to be on blah, 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 I've really sort of shut the door to that constructive dialogue.
Can be very empowering also to say to somebody, you're still suffering. I mean, I think this medicine was a good idea, but I don't think it's serving your needs. I would like us to become non-adherent to it and try something in its place. No, Dr. Goldberg, I like this medicine. Well, I'm skeptical. I mean, if you think it's really helpful, tell me. Otherwise, let's come up with something else because you and I are in this together to try to, meet the goals that you're after. All right. A couple more things I'll ask up before I let you go. Customized Adherence Enhancement is a program you've developed. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so Customized Adherence Enhancement is a behavioral approach that I've been working with for a number of years. I have a wonderful colleague here at Case Western Reserve University at the School of Medicine, Dr. Jennifer Levin, she and I have been conducting a number of research studies with this program, CAE, Customized Adherence Enhancement. The premise of the approach is that it is really critical to understand what people's barriers to medication adherence are, right? And we know there's a few, top 10 in our program. We actually have top four based on a whole body of research. And the idea here is that you assess, and we use some standardized metrics or survey tools to look at what people's barriers are. But if you're a clinician in practice, you can do the same thing by just asking people, what are the barriers, or what do you think is making it hard for you to stay on track with the medicine or to take it regularly? And then with CAE, once we identify those barriers, 1 through 4, then we deliver a brief modular behavioral intervention that targets those barriers. So if people have insufficient or inaccurate knowledge of the role of the medication, we use psychoeducation. If they have side effects or feel like the burden of the medicine exceeds the benefit, then we have communication with providers to say, to have, like, as we've talked about, this dialogue, right? Is it that I truly don't have options and I need to figure out some other lifestyle issues, or do I really have options? You mentioned earlier that some patients vote with their feet. They just stop going to their appointments. That's the worst way to manage adherence, because almost nothing's good is going to happen with that, right? But so communication with providers is really important. Some people have issues with concurrent substance use that impedes medication taking. So that's an important consideration, right? Again, a dialogue. Do we need some additional supports? Do I understand how my medication interfaces with whatever other substances I may be using? And then last is medication routine. So I talked about that a little bit with, you know, if your life is chaotic or if it's bedtime and you realize you haven't flossed today, you know, maybe could you work your flossing into another time where it would be reasonable for you to easily remember the flossing, right? Is it maybe you keep the little placards thing or whatever it is, someplace where you're going to see it before you leave your bathroom in the morning. You know, the idea being that we could build in tools and tips that would tie medication taking into some regular activity.
Yeah, so I guess this would in part be me coming along saying, what can we do to make this easier for you? I have patients who say, well, I fall asleep at night, I forget my nighttime medicines. Do you need to take it more than once a day? Can it be consolidated? Someone who's on a very elaborate regimen. Imagine this must be more difficult with older adults who are on non-psychotropic medicines as well. And you're almost, I'm assuming such people wouldn't necessarily be selectively non-adherent with their psych meds, but you're also wondering, are you taking your cardiac medicines? Are you taking your diabetes medicines? Are you taking your COPD medicine?
Yeah, I mean, both definitely happen. We're just concluding now a study for people with mood disorders who also have hypertension, who are poorly adherent with their hypertensive drugs. And people can be selectively adherent. They can also just skip a dose of timing. Some easy fixes, you know, I mentioned the pill boxes. Taking medications out of the original pill bottle that you get them in is almost always the worst way of taking medications, right?
It's the blue pill.
It's the blue pill. But also, you know, if you've got a 90-day supply of medication and you can't remember if you took it that day or not, which is very common, almost everybody says, well, I definitely don't want to double up on my medication, so I'm not going to take it, right? So just framing it in that way, if you put it in the pill box, that way, you know, if you've missed it, your pill box will tell you whether you've missed it or not. So that seems very simplistic, but sometimes these simple tools can be very, very, very helpful.
And last thing I want to ask you about, which could probably be in a whole nother hour, is when we do have drugs that are either very long half-lives that can help circumvent some of the problems with missed doses, or long-acting injectables, how do you present to patients, well, you know, if the convenience factor is an issue, we have ways that we can make a medicine more convenient. In the case of long-acting injectables, they come with stigma from a generation or two ago. How do you initiate that discussion?
Yeah, so I think this is where the normalization comes back in, right? Is that long-acting injectables have really taken off now that we have many more options. A lot of people are maintained on them. There is a body of literature also that suggests that if you are on oral medications, so sometimes people say, for instance, well, I still have to take drug A, B, and C, even if I get a long-acting injectable. Our data and other people's data suggests that adherence with a foundational treatment like a long-acting injectable antipsychotics is associated with improved adherence with concurrent oral drugs. So, you know, maybe you're cognitively functioning a little better. You don't have mm-hmm. the mood fluctuations, and you can just stay. Yeah, you can just stay on track. So, what I would say is, first of all, normalize it. A mm-hmm. lot more people are on these treatments, and then nothing is forever. Just like I asked you from last visit, is it better, worse, or the same? Let's try this for 6 months or 9 months or 12 months. And then we're going to sit down and say, is this better, worse, or the same?
That's a really wonderful point. It's a fluid dynamic. I can't tell you, I've had this forever. I don't know. I mean, let's continue it as long as it is. You and I both agree this is helpful, and we'll continue to revisit over the course of time because things change. It's the nature of everything, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow. Well, Martha, this has been so helpful for me. I hope it was equally helpful for our viewers and listeners in terms of how to think about approaching patients around the topic of adherence, proactively so, anticipating based on diagnostic features, symptom features, medication complexity, what might be some of the issues that come up, and to be able to anticipate problems before they arise is probably good preventive medicine in many ways. Any final comments you want to share before we sign off?
I would just say to our audience, think about adherence. That's a very first step. Yeah. And have a candid discussion with your patient.
Yeah, so, we're in this together. All right. Well, Dr. Sajjavik Martha, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope everyone out there has found this as useful and helpful as I. We hope to see you again real soon on our program. And bye for now.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.